Bring It On is a public affairs program exploring the people, issues, and events affecting the African-American communities in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Bring It On is a forum for the people, by the people, produced by an independent team of volunteers working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana,
and financially supported by listeners like you.
Good evening. I'm William Hosea, and welcome to Bring It On. Celebrating more than 6 years as Indiana's only weekly community radio show committed to exploring the people, issues, and events impacting the African-American community.
Hello, I am Bev Smith.
Welcome back.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be back in the seat. And we'll also give you the real scoop on what's going on in the African-American world of news and events all in the next hour. Excuse me, right here on Bring It On.
But before we do, Dr. David Pilgrim is a public speaker and one of this country's leading experts on issues relating to multiculturalism, diversity, and race relations. He's been interviewed by National Public Radio, Time Magazine, the British Broadcasting Corporation, and dozens of newspapers, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune, and the Los Angeles Times.
Dr. Pilgrim is best known as the founder and curator of the Jim Crow Museum, a 5,000-piece collection of racist artifacts located at Ferris State University. The museum uses objects of intolerance to teach tolerance. The new Jim Crow Museum is now open to the public. The museum features six exhibit areas: Who and What is Jim Crow?, Jim Crow Violence, Jim Crow and Anti-Black Imagery, Battling Jim Crow Imagery, Attacking Jim Crow Segregation, and Beyond Jim Crow.
The grand opening of the museum took place over the weekend. In tribute to this, we asked Bring It On contributors Liz Mitchell, herself a collector of racist memorabilia, and Cornelius Wright to discuss the impact of the museum and its revealing collection with the founder and curator, Dr. David Pilgrim. What follows is a conversation recorded earlier this afternoon.
This is Cornelius Wright.
And this is Liz Mitchell with Bring It On.
As William and Bev just shared, we are fortunate to take some time to speak with Dr. David Pilgrim, the founder and curator of the new Jim Crow Museum on the Ferris State University campus.
Dr. Pilgrim, welcome to Bring It On.
I'm glad to be here.
First of all, I just want to say that I collect Jim Crow also, and I started 30 years ago. And so I just had to get on this interview to talk with you about collecting. Okay. Now, what was your first piece, and why did you collect it?
Back when I was a teenager growing up in Mobile, I saw if my memory serves me right, I saw a mammy-like salt and pepper shaker. Probably was a few cents to a nickel. Purchased it, broke it. So the answer to the question is I purchased it to break it.
Wow.
I don't remember the second, third, or fourth piece, but shortly thereafter, certainly by the time I got to college, I was buying it to buying those pieces to use them as parts of lectures when I travel around talking about civil rights in the Jim Crow period.
Okay.
Now, I know that you mentioned that you broke the first salt shaker that you bought. When you started collecting other pieces, what changed your mind about breaking them as far as collecting them, and then what got you into wanting to do it as an educational ploy?
I think part of it is when I went to Jarvis Christian College, which is a historically black college out in Hawkins, Texas. And while I was a student there, most of my instructors were African Americans, and you know, they told the lessons of Jim Crow, and I didn't want people forgetting those lessons. Moreover, I thought that some of those old lessons kind of morph into the present. So I think that was, you know, if I had to pick a period of my life, it was probably those years because of the influence of my instructors.
Now, you mentioned Jim Crow, and for a lot of our listeners that may not be old enough to remember Jim Crow and a lot of the Jim Crow laws, would you kind of give us some background on the Jim Crow laws and the time frame that happened in our country?
Yeah, well, when I think of Jim Crow, I'll answer the first part, which is Jim Crow, probably in the early 1800s, was a slur, sort of like the word darky or coon. It was then picked up, at least according to legend, it was picked up by a white man by the name of Thomas Rice, who created a stage character, dressed him in blackface, acted like a buffoon, pretending to be black, and became nationally and internationally famous. It wasn't long after that before what he was doing on stage to mock African-Americans became a synonym for all things that put blacks down, not just the laws, because most people think of Jim Crow, they think of just the segregation laws, whereas when I think of Jim Crow, I think of the entire racial system, of the racial hierarchy with whites at the top and blacks at the bottom. So there were Jim Crow laws, but there were also customs and etiquette and taste and values that were all Jim Crow. So it was a whole system of life. And I would say it's kind of hard to put a time frame on it, but I would say it would probably be from the 1870s to the mid-1960s.
All right.
Okay. And one question I had about the Jim Crow laws, as, and I realized they started as the Black Codes and then developed into those laws from that, but they really did a lot of damage all the way around. Can you explain to our listening audience some of the damage that, that Jim Crow has done, mentally, physically, whatever, to our youth and even as adults?
Sure. Well, the Jim Crow thinking, the whole Jim Crow psychic, was used to justify discrimination against Africans and their American descendants. So these laws, these customs were in every part of our culture. So when you went to church, you heard ministers preaching in favor of segregation. You had in the some of the best institutions in this country, you had scholars coming up with research which they argued proved and demonstrated that blacks were not the intellectual, social, or in any way the equivalents of whites. As a matter of fact, you could make the argument that every major societal institution bought into Jim Crow. And so what were the results of that? Well, just think about it. If thousands and thousands and thousands of everyday objects teach you that you're inferior, if the movies you watch, if the books you read teach you that, if in the workplace you are denied opportunities to work in certain jobs, if you can't vote in some places, in other words, if you're treated as a second-class citizen, which is in effect what Jim Crow was, just another name for that, it's not surprising then that some of those negative feelings were internalized by African Americans, and that for some of us, we continue to struggle to this day. Now, I do want to add this, though. I think my generation of African Americans can be faulted because in too many instances, we did not teach the lessons of Jim Crow to our children. I don't know if we were just fatigued, you know, because you just sometimes you get tired. So I don't know if that was a part of it. I don't know if it was a kind of shame, although the shame is not ours. It was America's shame. I don't know what it was. But the reality is that too many young African-Americans today lack even a basic knowledge of what occurred during the Jim Crow period.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your collecting, this is what I've experienced in my collecting. Whites as well as blacks wanted to know, why would I collect such a thing? Mm-hmm. And was I a racist because I collected it?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I get that from some people. I don't get it as much. You know, early on, I worried about that. And periodically, I'd hear someone, they'd say, well, you know, you're building a shrine to racism. And my answer to that is that the Jim Crow Museum is a shrine to racism in the same way that a hospital is a shrine to disease. We are not a shrine. What we are is a place where people are not just encouraged to talk intelligently about race, but they're educated about where we've been as a society, and then we create a safe space where we can engage in meaningful, even if it's a difficult, conversation. And that's just been an old thing for too many Americans, where if you bring up difficult topics, there must be something wrong with you. You know, the whole kill the messenger type idea. But we're not afraid to talk about race. We're not afraid to talk about the past. And the reality is that one of the most popular sections of the new Jim Crow Museum is actually not about the past. It's about racist objects that have been created in the last 5 or 10 years. So it's not like these things are just confined to the past.
And that's interesting that you should bring that up. And before we get into some of the things that you've collected, I have a couple of, well, I have a question and a statement. A lot of the blackface, the jockey figures, there's a lot of talk about at one time that that was actually a sign for slaves to know that these were houses that were safe as they were coming from the South, the whole Jocko Graves mystique. Could you explain that a little bit and clarify it for us also?
Well, I actually did some research on that, and what I'll tell you is that the whole thing about the little boy freezing to death, you know, holding a lantern for George Washington, I don't think there's any evidence for that. I think there is some evidence that in some instances, you know, putting a red handkerchief or a purple handkerchief in the left hand or the right hand of a statue in front of your house might have been a way to signal to runaway slaves. But, you know, the other way to look at it is almost anything you say about America's history with slavery is probably going to be true. And by that I mean this, that you're talking about a 200-year period, and you're talking about many, 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 many people being involved. So I have no doubt that one of the ways that at least some people signal slaves was to use whatever ornaments, what we call them, are lawn warts, whichever ones were in your yard. So that would not surprise me. I don't think that's the meaning that it has today. I don't think it's the meaning that it has had, you know, in many years. But I don't doubt, and as a matter of fact, I have some reason to suspect that sometimes that was done.
Okay. You mentioned how some of the things that you collect now are also being made today. Our producer sent us something. It's a Diana Ross Afro Brillo pad that looks like Diana. And when I saw it, the first thing I thought was this has to be from the 60s, and it's something recent and current. Can you explain some of the things that are still happening as well as your vast collection?
Well, what I would say is that every image that's in the museum is still being created. Sometimes they're being created to fool people like they are authentic antiques. Sometimes they morph into a new thing. So, you know, there's pieces that had the N-word on them, like oysters and stuff. And so what the person has done is take that image off of the can and now today puts it on the face of a clock. That's fairly common. Or reproduces it as a 10. Now, this is not to say that we're not more democratic and egalitarian than we used to be, but the fact is there's still a very large market for racist objects. If you look at the ascendancy of President Obama, the truth of the matter is that we could have an entire museum just on objects that racially, not just criticize him, but that racially defame the President of the United States.
That's correct.
T-shirts that say things like any white guy in 2012, ones that say, you know, don't renege in 2012, baskets and handbags that portray the First Lady as, you know, a mammy with a sambo shining her shoes in the president. I mean, you think of pretty much any traditional racist stereotype of African Americans, and they've been applied to the President of the United States. So I think that's as good an example as any. But of course, what I would argue is that there's also new caricatures, not just the old Toms and Sambos and Mammies and the like, but there's new caricatures created of African Americans.
Okay. I'm looking at one of the photos. In fact, the photo of the entrance as you pass through to your museum, and it's a large, enormous mouth of a black waiter, and I recognize that as being the doorway to Coon Chicken Inn.
Yeah, you're right.
Can you tell our listening audience about Coon Chicken Inn restaurants?
Yeah, that was, I guess you call it a chain. There was three or four of them. I'm proud to say, being from Alabama, that they were not from the Deep South, that they were from Seattle, Washington, Portland, Oregon, Salt Lake City, those type places. They existed up until the 1950s. And if you wanted to create a place that was like an umbrella for every racist thing, people performing in blackface, you know, the whole, you know, the fried chicken, And by the way, there's nothing inherently racist about fried chicken, but, you know, they intentionally tried to be racist with their menu. Just, you know, every racist stereotype you could think of happened there, including having the porter, the coon chicken in porter's mouth being the entrance to the restaurant. So you can imagine driving down the street seeing that. Well, what we wanted to do before in the museum was when we showed the when we want to introduce people to the role that caricatures play, that everyday objects and their images, the images on them played, we thought it would be good to reproduce the mouth so that, in effect, you're doing the same thing that people in Salt Lake City did, or Portland, Oregon, is that you're walking through that grotesque caricatured image of an African-American.
Yeah.
You know, it was interesting. As I was coming to the radio station, I was showing a coworker what the topic was. And jokingly, she said, yeah, you know, my husband often wondered if Uncle Ben married Aunt Jemima. And with that in mind, as I'm looking at some of just the things that are out there, and every day you go to the grocery store, Aunt Jemima pancake flour has been a staple of this country. Mm-hmm. Cream of wheat, Uncle Ben. Could you talk about how this affects not only the white community, but the black community in how we feel about ourselves?
Well, I guess the way I would respond to that is one of the questions that we ask in the museum. We bring an object before people, an image before people, and then we ask them, so you tell me what it is you see when you see this. Now, in the case of Aunt Jemima, that image is not nearly as caricatured as it was in the past, and many Americans don't even understand the connection between Aunt Jemima, this mammy-type figure, and the vestiges of slavery and segregation. They don't get that. But they do see something. And for us, we say an object doesn't have to be racist, per se, to be in the museum, but it has to be useful to get us to talk about race and race relations and racism. So we would bring out an object like that, an image like that, and ask people, what is it you see? And it's so fascinating because, you know, when some people see Aunt Jemima imagery, what they see is a kind of nostalgic, you know, good times that they experienced with their family growing up. They don't see anything mean-spirited, and that's fine. But then for other people, what they see is a kind of slur, you know, again, the vestiges of slavery and segregation. So for us, the value is putting both of those people or those groups into the same room and creating a space where they're free to talk about what they see. You know, too many Americans, you know, claim that race relations will get better if we just stop talking about it. Well, we think the opposite. We believe that they won't get better until we have mature, honest discussions. And it's interesting that you mentioned Aunt Jemima, because we have some of our best discussions in the museum about Aunt Jemima, because people bring such different views with them.
I would really be interested to hear a lot of the different views, all not only from white, black, but from young black,
sure,
and older blacks.
Well, and you would especially, you know, I think we spend way too much time in the museum debating the N-word. I mean, anybody who's read any of my writings know that I have some very strong feelings about that word. I mean, I don't want to start preaching, but you know, I grew up in the Deep South. Maybe it's a generational thing because I'm an old man right now. But, you know, you wouldn't call the four little girls that were killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church that. You wouldn't call Rosa Parks that. You wouldn't call all the dignified black maids and butlers who marched in the Civil Rights Movement. You wouldn't call any of them that. Then neither are their children or their descendants. But in the museum itself, we do pick up, you know, and again, you know, I have my views, other people have their views, but that's a generational thing where you get a lot of young African Americans, again, they don't see the world or the word exactly the way I do, and that's fine. My job's not to proselytize them and convince them, but it is to create a place where we can have good dialogue. That's why we're in college, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I just flipped the screen to look at another photo you have. It's a picture of the very first piece that I bought 30 years ago. It's a grocery store list that says, Reckon I Needs, with Mammy at the top, and it is a wooden list. Yeah. And you stick the pigs in it to say whether you need apples, bacon, bread, or butter, etc.
That's right.
And with this mammy on it, I'd like for you to talk about the different characters. There's the mammy.
Right, right.
Versus Jezebel.
Yeah. Well, see, like mammy would be, you know, and I hasten to add that I want people to visit our website because we have essays on all of these caricatures, and all you have to do is just type in Jim Crow in Google, and it'll pull up the museum.
Okay.
And so they'd get a much longer thing, but just succinctly, you know, Mammy was portrayed, Mammy portrayed, rather, black women as large women, dark-skinned women who didn't care about their own families, were in some sense desexualized. I mean, even though they may have had children, they were presented as physically unattractive. They were sometimes mean and bossy and all of this, but the most offensive part for me would be that just that they were portrayed as loving the white family more than their own. And if we read the article that we wrote, one of the things you'll find out is that the image of Mammy in cinema and the like, it's just inaccurate. It was inaccurate during slavery. It was inaccurate, you know, after slavery. A couple others, you know, the so-called Tom caricature would be sort of like the male version of the Mammy. Again, you know, not complaining about their status, in some ways weak, even though it's not the original Tom that Harriet Beecher Stowe created. The Jezebel, which I believe was created as an image of African-American women to justify, you know, white men raping them during slavery. And so the black woman was portrayed as this temptress, this seductress, you know, and so it wasn't the white guy's fault, you know, that this woman had gotten raped. You have the Sapphire, which is like the, quote, angry black woman piece. And you see how these things morph into the present. They don't just die. You
yes.
know, the brute caricature, which emerged after Reconstruction, which is the black male as this threatening menace to society, that didn't really exist during slavery because of the fear that it would be a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know. But now it's like one of the most dominant images of young black males. And, again, it hasn't died. There's the tragic mulatto, there's the so-called pickaninny, which is the idea of young black children naked, near naked, running from alligators, little buffoons. You know, every group that exists in this country, every racial group has been caricatured, but no group has been caricatured as much, as often, and maybe as harshly as have Africans and their American descendants.
Indeed. We are speaking with Dr. David Pilgrim about his collection at the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia. It opened April 26th at Ferris University in Michigan, where Dr. Pilgrim spent years as a sociology professor. Now, Dr. Pilgrim, I do have a question. I know that the museum is divided into sections. Would you talk about some of those sections and what is displayed in each one?
The first section, well, outside, we have a timeline. And that's one of the reasons I'm really glad we could move, because we could do that. So we start, you know, by telling people, you know, we have a little section which tells people that the African existence in this world did not start with slavery in the U.S. So we talk a little bit about African civilizations. Then in the U.S., we have a section on slavery, Jim Crow, the Civil Rights Movement, and the post-Civil Rights Movement. And so this is all still outside. Then we have a few collections that are outside of people that donated material here. Like your co-host may get the burning desire at some point in her life to donate her collection to the Jim Crow Museum. we will.
I might do that.
I do that. Once you get inside, we start by just telling people who was Jim Crow, because you're right, a lot of people don't know. And then we show the relationship between Jim Crow, the stage character, and minstrel shows, and then we show how that then became Jim Crow as we more commonly understand it, about segregation. And then the most difficult part of the museum is the section on violence, and the reality is that Jim Crow segregation would not have existed in this country without real violence and the threat of violence. And so it's a real tough section to, you know, to deal with. Franklin Hughes, who works in my office, created a video on violence that, if you don't cry when you watch this, you are a rutabaga. I mean, it is a powerful piece. And then we want to show how everyday objects, It wasn't just violence that supported Jim Crow. It was everyday objects. And so we created a kitchen. And in the kitchen, you can see all the things that would be in a kitchen. It's a little bit over the top. I mean, there may be 500 objects sitting on a counter. And then we go through each of the caricatures, the major caricatures. We have a television set which shows cartoons from, you know, the 30s, the 40s, but also cartoons from the present. You know, you'd be surprised some of the racist cartoons that are out there right now. We then have a fireplace and a mantle that has, you know, tons and tons of mammy stuff. We have a showcase that has toys and games, just as many, again, just we want to show people how omnipresent these things were. But the most, for me, the most gratifying part of the museum are the next sections, and why I really worked so hard all these years to get the museum built, because I wanted to show sections about African-American achievement. Despite the violence, despite the laws, despite the rule, despite a whole country being set up so you would fail, we still had brilliant African-Americans. So we have a section on African-American thinkers. We have one on politicians, blacks in the military, you know, and then a few other areas, because we really want to show, just the human resiliency, not just African-American resiliency, but in this case, so. Then we have a small section on the civil rights era. And then there's that really big showcase I was telling you about the new objects, a couple other small pieces. And then if you skip a little bit, when you get around to the end, when I was growing up, you know, the old folks down south, they would try to keep you out of trouble. So they always tell you that God's watching you. What they used to tell me is you don't want to be doing certain things tonight, because if you die, that's how, whatever you're doing when you die, that's what you're going to be doing when you appear before God. And then when they figured that wouldn't work, then they just said, well, you know, like, there's all these witnesses always watching you. And that stuck in my head. Didn't stop me from doing every bad thing, but it did stick in my head. And so we created a cloud of witnesses, which are blacks and whites who died during the Civil Rights Movement. And that's the little room of reflection we have, so that while we're talking about what it is you just saw, and more importantly, what is it America needs to be doing to improve, we have these witnesses watching us, you know, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Megar Evers and the four little girls that died in the Civil Rights Movement, and Viola Liauza, the white woman, you know, from this area who went down south and got killed, and Goodman, Cheney, and Swerner, and others. And for me, that was the most touching part. You know, one day when it first got built and I went over by myself, of course, I was over there for 15 minutes, but, you know, I went in there and had a chance to sit by myself, sat in there, because I remember, you know, those stories when I was growing up, and it's important to acknowledge our ancestors, but also to recognize that we build on the work they did. When I walked across the stage to get a PhD from Ohio State, it wasn't like I did that by myself.
And you've included in your museum some things I wouldn't have even thought of, by starting at the beginning and then showing how far we've come and what we've done despite of. Honey, I'm coming.
Come on.
Indeed. Would you let our listeners know not only where the museum is, but when it's open, how much does it cost? And again, will there be any chance that this show will be put on the road to other universities like Indiana University?
Yeah, well, we have a couple of traveling exhibits. They're not super large. They probably have about 40 units in each of them. We've had those for a few years. And if you visit our website, again, you can just type in Jim Crow at Google and it'll pull up the museum. It'll talk to you about the two traveling exhibits right now. It's so cool. One of them is at the Mark Twain House, and the other one is like 50 feet away at the Harriet Beecher Stowe House. You know, and so we have those two traveling exhibits there. So if people want to see what's in them, they can just pull it up on the web. In terms of cost, we are, that I know of, the only museum in this country that's free.
All right, now.
And we are free for a reason. We're free because we ain't trying to make no money off of this. What we're trying to do is to help people change. And so we want to be accessible to everybody. So people just come. In terms of being open, we're still working through that. So far, we're just open Monday through Friday from 12 to 5. But the demand, quite frankly, was greater than what we had anticipated. So we're looking at some staffing stuff so we can be open more than that. But it's open from 12 to 5 and by appointment. So if you knew you were coming and it was at a different time, I would make arrangements for you to be in there.
All righty. Well, okay. I'm definitely going to make a road trip with my children and grandchildren because this is fast. When I first read about it, I thought it was fascinating. And the more I've talked to you and listened to you speak.
Okay.
All right. Well, Dr. Pilgrim, it has certainly been a pleasure speaking with you about the new Jim Crow Museum and your efforts to incorporate objects of intolerance to teach tolerance.
Yes, and promote social justice.
All right.
Yes, absolutely. All right.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking to the both of you.
And now we will send it back live to the Bring It On with Wim and Bev.
We want to thank Dr. David Pilgrim for taking time to speak with our Bring It On contributors, Liz Mitchell and Cornelius Wright. To learn more about the museum located on the Ferris State University campus in Big Rapids, Michigan, go to www.ferris.edu/Jim Crow.
This is Bring It On, Indiana's only public affairs program dedicated to the African American community, here on WFHB 91.3 FM on your radio dial and live on the web at wfhb.org.
Bring It On has an open submission policy, so if you have an idea for this program, let's hear it. Send an email directly to our volunteer staff. The address is bringiton@wfhb.org. We want to make sure we share everything and anything affecting the African American community with our listening audience, which happens to be in Bloomington and beyond. The email address once again is bringiton@wfhb.org.
Everybody thinks we're all the mother. Who are they to judge us?
Mother, mother.
Simply call me sweet, where I hello.
Mother, mother.
And you just heard Marvin Gaye's classic Inner City Blues, Makes Me Wanna Holler, often shortened to just Inner City Blues. This song was released as the third and final single from and the climactic song of his 1971 landmark album, What's Going On. Written by Gaye and James Nix, the song depicted the ghettos of inner city America as it discussed how the bleak economic situation would lead to someone wanting to holler and throw one's hands up. The song was recorded in a mellow funk style with Gaye playing the piano. Several of the Funk Brothers also contributed, including Eddie Bongo Brown and bassist Bob Babbitt. This song was requested by today's bio interview guest, Dr. David Pilgrim.
This is Bring It On, the People's Forum for Black Culture in South Central Indiana and beyond. Are you a tweeter? You're invited to follow the WFHB News Twitter account. This is a great way to get breaking news and updates on what's going on behind the scenes and on the air with WFHB News. Go to twitter.com and search for WFHB News, or you can always visit the WFHB News website at wfhb.org/news.
It is now time to give you the latest on the people, news, and issues affecting the African-American community. For Bring It On, I'm William Hosea.
And I'm Bev Smith. First up, we have Mitt Romney, the Secret Service, GOP, Obama mocks them all, according to the Sun Times. This year's primaries, the 2008 primaries, the General Service Administration scandal, even the Secret Service and Donald Trump were targets for President Barack Obama's scattershot humor on Saturday night's celebrity-studded White House Correspondents' Dinner. Even the entrance to his speech was part of his shtick. The president walked off stage just before he took the podium with an alleged hot mic, making fun of getting caught last month on an open microphone with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. "What am I doing here?" he asked off stage. "I'm opening for Jimmy Kimmel and telling knock-knock jokes for Kim Kardashian." Obama also took a shot at the Republican congressional leadership, whom he thanked for taking time from their exhausting schedule of not passing any laws to attend the dinner. Four years ago, Obama recalled, he was locked in a tough primary fight with Hillary Clinton. "Now his Secretary of State, she can't stop drunk texting me from Cartagena," he said, referring to their recent trip to the Summit of the Americas in Colombia. This year, Obama is the incumbent, but the dinner was far from a campaign-free zone. The president pointed out his similarities to the presumed Republican nominee Mitt Romney. The president said, "We both have degrees from Harvard. I have one. He has two. What a snob." The crack drew a thumbs up from former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, who was in the audience. Santorum dropped out of the presidential primary campaign earlier this month. He had called Obama a snob for encouraging young Americans to attend college.
Texana Edwards knows how to make an entrance. The senior at Gibson County High School in Dyer, Tennessee, arrived at her prom with a dress that turned heads, featuring a pattern of the Confederate flag. School officials turned Edwards away, telling her she could return if she changed her dress. Edwards refused, at a loss for why her dress was offensive and inappropriate. Her defense was, "Black people loved it. We kept asking people walking inside, black and white, and everyone said they loved it," Edwards claims. Two black women even went off on the principal. "They were upset with the principal. No one was upset with me." Yeah, right.
Black hockey player scores winning goal and also receives death threats, according to BlackAmericaWeb.com. Washington Capitals forward Joel Ward didn't let the racist response of some Boston Bruins fans to his overtime game-winning, series-clinching goal Wednesday night that defeated the Stanley Cup champion Bruins spoil the moment for him. "It doesn't faze me at all," Ward told USA Today Sports on Thursday. "We won and we're moving on. People are going to say what they want to say." And what some Bruins fans said in tweets and emails shortly after Ward slid the puck under Boston goalie Tim Thomas to become the first Black player in National Hockey League history to score a series-ending overtime goal was downright racist. The fact that that an N scored the winning goal makes the loss hurt more, one tweet read. "Warning to Joel Ward, you're one of three Black guys in Canada. I will find you and I will kill you," yet another tweet screamed. The NHL, Boston Bruins, and Washington Capitals management weren't forgiving. The league issued a statement stating the racially charged comments distributed via digital media following last night's game were ignorant and unacceptable. "The people responsible for these comments have no place associating themselves with our game," the statement concluded. The tweets were especially egregious given Boston's role in Black hockey history. Willie O'Ree, who broke the league's color barrier in 1958, did it in a Boston Bruins uniform. Mike Greer, a recently retired NHL player and relative of NFL great Rosie Greer, had a stellar collegiate career skating for Boston University. Black players are a small but growing number in the NHL. Some 38 minority players had permanent spots of NHL rosters during the 2011-2012 regular season. Of that group, 18 players were Black, 8 were Native, Aboriginal, 4 were Hispanic, 2 were West Asian or Arab, and 1 was Inuit. 1 was a Haitian and West Indian, and the other an East Asian, according to the league's figures. Interesting.
In the wake of the Trayvon Martin shooting tragedy, Ann Coulter, the incorrigibly bombastic right-wing activist, took to the Fox News airwaves and the Bill O'Reilly Show recently to expound upon and defiantly reaffirm her dangerously hot-headed and short-sighted views regarding the one singular instrument that has truly proven to be a weapon of mass destruction in minority communities everywhere. "We don't know all the facts yet," Coulter later wrote in a blog post chronicling the deadly encounter that left the 17-year-old Martin mortally wounded at the hands of volunteer neighborhood watchman George Zimmerman. "But let's assume the conclusion MSNBC is leaping to is accurate. George Zimmerman stalked a small Black child and murdered him in cold blood just because he was Black. If that were true," she continued, "every Black person in America should get a gun and join the National Rifle Association, America's oldest and most august civil rights organization." Incorrigibly bombastic. I got to remember that one.
All right, next week we'll do a pop quiz on it. Leadership Summit to hold town hall meeting on the development of Black men. Now in its 8th year, the NAACP Leadership 500 Summit convened some of the most talented and well-networked professionals, advocates, and community leaders to strategize around issues like this that affect communities nationwide. It has always been up to the Leadership 500 community to tackle the issues of consequence. When the summit convenes in Florida on May 24th through the 27th, the NAACP will host a town hall to discuss the state of men of color in America and find community solutions to help reverse alarming trends in communities related to the criminal justice system, including Black-on-Black crime, relations with law enforcement, and the justice system, and education. The Trayvon Martin case hit home for many. His case is one of many where Black men are marginalized, criminalized, and mistreated by the very systems that are supposed to develop them. "We are encouraged by the arrest of George Zimmerman. However, the NAACP knows that it's just the beginning of a movement to create a safer America for our children and a better America for all of us." In addition to the town hall, the summit will engage, discuss, and develop plans for action on many issues posing threats to people of color in America. "Your voice is important to the NAACP as they take on these issues. Register today for the NAACP Leadership 500 Summit. They will host an expert-led strategy session in a variety of advocacy, community, and professional areas, including education, entrepreneurship, justice, health, media and technology, and economic empowerment.
Detroit Tigers outfielder Delmon Young was arrested Friday morning outside of a hotel in Midtown Manhattan following an altercation with a group of men. Young is also accused of yelling anti-Semitic slurs at a panhandler, which may have contributed to the altercation. Young was alleged to be highly intoxicated when he got into a heated argument with a group of men outside of the Hilton New York Hotel on 6th Avenue and East 54th Street in Manhattan around 2:40 a.m. on Friday. It is unclear what caused the fight, but it involved Young, a group of four men, and panhandler. Police officials declined to say exactly what Young said to the panhandler, but according to initial reports from the New York Post, Young yelled expletive Jews at the panhandler. Young is awaiting arraignment and has been charged with aggravated harassment and third-degree assault. NYPD investigators are looking into possible hate crime charges in connection with the anti-Semitic slurs. Tigers Vice President of Communications Ron Colangelo said the team has no official comment at this time. The Tigers were in New York to start a three-game series with the New York Yankees.
And America's angriest theologian faces lynching tree. According to CNN, when he was a boy growing up in rural Arkansas, James Cone would often stand at his window at night, looking for a sign that his father was still alive. Cone had reason to worry. He lived in a small, segregated town in the age of Jim Crow, and his father, Charlie Cone, was a marked man. Charlie Cone wouldn't answer to any white man who called him boy. He only worked for himself. He told his sons because a black man couldn't work for a white man and keep his manhood at the same time. Once, when he was warned that a lynch mob was coming to run him out of his home, he grabbed a shotgun and waited, saying, "Let them come, because some of them will die with me." James Cone knew the risks of his risks that his father took. So when his father didn't come home at his usual time in the evenings, he would stand sentry, looking for the lights from his father's pickup truck. "I had heard too much about white people killing black people," Cone recalled. "When my father would finally make it home safely, I would run and jump in his arms, as happy as I could be." Cone left his hometown of Bearden, Arkansas, and became one of the world's most influential theologians. But the memories of his father and lynch mobs never left him. Those memories shaped his controversial theology, and they saturate his recent memoir, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. Cone, who once called himself the angriest theologian in America, is still angry. His book is not just a memoir for growing up in the Jim Crow era, it's a blistering takedown of white churches and one of America's greatest theologians, Reinhold Niebuhr, the colossal figure often cited by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
And that was a look at African American headline news from around the world for this week. Tune in again next week for the latest news on and for the African-American community. We want to know what you think of current black issues. Please send your comments to bringiton@wfhb.org. For WFHB, I'm William Hosea.
And I'm Bev Smith. This is Bring It On, Indiana's only public affairs program dedicated to the African-American community. We're right here on WFHB 91.3 FM on your radio dial, and we're live on the web at wfhb.org.
It's time to highlight a few local events of interest to the black community with our weekly event calendar. For Bring It On, I'm William Hosea.
And I'm Bev Smith. The 2012 Commission on the Status of Black Males has a meeting schedule that you should know about. Commission meetings are open to the public and take place in the Hooker Conference Room, which is number 245 in City Hall, 401 North Morton Street, Bloomington, of course. Please join us on, or join them, I happen to be one of the us's, on May 9th at 4:15 p.m.
Poll workers are needed now. There are many more poll workers needed for the May 8th primary election. Inspector, judge, clerk, and sheriff positions are open in most parts of the county. These are paid positions and a training session is required. Judges, clerks, and sheriffs are paid $90 for the day. Inspectors are paid $140 for the day. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner will be provided. The day starts at 5 a.m. and ends when the election documents are all signed and put in order and the polling place is returned to its original condition. The inspector and the Republican judge will then deliver all the election materials and equipment to the Justice Building. We also need six people to work at the Justice Building after the polls close until all the votes are tabulated. These people will be paid $10.50 per hour. Poll workers are required to be A, a registered voter of Monroe County, B, not a candidate, spouse, child, parent, father-in-law, mother-in-law, grandparent, grandchild, brother, sister, brother-in-law, sister-in-law, uncle, aunt, nephew, or niece of a candidate. Exception is unopposed candidate for precinct, committeeman, or state delegate. And C, not a chairman or treasurer to a candidate's committee. If you're interested in serving on May 8th, or if you have questions, call the county clerk's office at 812-349-5003 or email county clerk Linda Robbins at lrobbins@co.monroe.in.us. Your help is greatly appreciated.
And wrapping up, the NAACP Monroe County Branch has a meeting coming up. Please attend branch meeting on Tuesday, May 1st at Second Baptist Church at 7 p.m. The major agenda items will be the scholarship and the review of the community conversation.
If you have an event or happening the African American community should know about, please send that information directly to the Bring It On staff. Or if you want additional information about a calendar item that you've heard tonight, contact us at bringiton@wfhb.org.
We want to thank Dr. David Pilgrim for taking the time to speak with our Bring It On contributors, the fabulous Liz Mitchell and the impressive Cornelius Wright. To learn more about the museum located on the Ferris State University campus in Big Rapids, Michigan, go straight to www.ferris.edu/Jim Crow.
Bring It On is produced by Clarence Boone with support from executive producer Allison Bektesh. Our news editor is Michael Nolan. Our board engineer is Chris Martin. Our original theme music was created by Jamil Effiam with additional background tracks by David Baker. For WFHB, I'm William Hosea.
And I'm Bev Smith. Tune in again next week on Monday, May 7th at 6 p.m. for another exciting Bring It On broadcast right here on your community radio station, WFHB.
You've been listening to Bring It On, a volunteer-powered production of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Bring It On is your forum for open dialogue on the people, issues, and events affecting the African-American community in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas directly to the Bring It On staff. The email address is bringit@wfhb.org.
That's bringit@wfhb.org.